This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jade Richards, and today I have the great pleasure of introducing to you the authors of The Activist Academic, Engaged Scholarship for Resistance, Hope, and Social Change. And they are today Professor Colette N. Cann, who's the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Faculty Advancement, a professor in the School of Education at the University of San Francisco, and Professor Eric J. de Molinaire. He's a Professor of Education, Director of Community, Youth and Education Studies, Director of Comparative Race and Ethnic Studies at Clark University. Colette and Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Super excited to be here.
That's fabulous to have you. I really enjoyed your book, genuinely. So it's great to have you here. Just to get us started, can you tell me a little bit about both yourselves and how you came to write The Activist Academic?
Oh, thank you. Eric is gesturing. Let me go first. Thank you so much, Eric. Let's see. We came to write the Activist Academic in our first years, actually, as assistant professors, that's first level professors in the U.S. It was my first position, as well as Eric's first position. And we had both been educators in the TK-12 system, so pre-university for a while, and also had been activists in the work that we did. And we were finding the transition to academia to be challenging, not in the work that we were doing, but in the work that it seemed we didn't get a chance to do, the work that wasn't being acknowledged as important. And so we found that we were doing trying to meet the regular expectations, research, teaching, and service. And then on top of that, doing work that was really important to us, partnering with community organizations and schools to make sure that youth were being served, particularly BIPOC youth in the communities in which we were living and also engaged. And so we were, it sounds funny now, we were on this old antiquated way of communicating called Skype, which I remember at the time really giving Eric a hard time about. I was like, why do we have to be on Skype? What the phone? What the phone isn't good enough anymore. really just talking all the time about how we were managing and oftentimes not really managing this balance, right? And but how frustrated we were. And so really, the book itself came out of authentic conversations that we were having that were really kind of saving our spirits and our souls and our hearts in the work that we were doing. Eric, what say you?
Yeah. Well, and I'll just add on that. I think, you know, when I went to grad school with the intention of starting a high school and developing the networks and the power to do that, and was not thinking about an academic career at all. And so for various reasons, that trajectory ended. And there was a lot of political challenges with that. And I remember talking with my mentor, Margo Okazawa, who was like, you know, Eric, you gotta, you know, the academia is not just some elitist ivory tower where you lose touch with the world, which is, I think, some of the stereotype I had had in my head about it. And she sort of pushed me to think about it. She was like, where other job can you have this flexibility with your schedule and control how much time you spend in different things? So I entered into academia, maybe a little reluctant, or sort of escaped there from doing work in K-12 education, but didn't want to lose that work and leave that behind. And, you know, remember reading in grad school Gramsci's notion that, like, most academics think that they're, you know, challenging the dominant narratives, but they're actually really complicit. And I was like, I don't want to be one of those. And so for me, the conversations with Colette were finding an accountability partner. How do I live into the values I claim and not just sell out to sort of the prestige or whatever of academia and the luxury of it, right, on one level. And so for me, it was a space of holding myself accountable. And then also thinking, I think also what I learned at Berkeley when we were both in Berkeley together was that, like, there was a commitment to activism, but activism was over here on one side and scholarship was over here and there too. And so I think at the beginning, it was for me trying to figure out, like, how do I balance these? And I think as we continued to start thinking and writing, it was more about how do I stop trying to balance and actually try to make both come together, right? And for me, I think, you know, it was just, I was struggling a lot, and so it was also just cathartic. Like, I think we started writing, I don't think we had an intention of publishing anything. We just started writing and we got pages and pages in and we're like, is there anything here we should do with this to get our, you know, academic profile in place, I think. And so then it became sort of like, yeah, it was a really catharsis, but also it became kind of this work of love for me and really exploring what that meant. And then it was a relational practice that was also really important for me as well.
I think one thing that really struck me in the book was the authenticity that did come through. It was, you know, from the outset, you talked, you just touched on now how it was this sort of catharsis, and all of these authentic conversations that you just mentioned, Colette, actually come through in the book. And I have to say, I've never read an academic book. It's not what I was expecting at all. I've never read any sort of academic book where you open it and you're reading about the process and the journey that you went on as you were writing. I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about those authentic conversations and how you sort of went from that space to writing to the final output.
Want me to start this one? I mean, we actually, I think, captured it pretty accurately in the book. I remember one time having the conversation, and I don't know what Colette had read, but it was some sort of autoethnographic piece that we were less familiar with, or I had been less familiar with that is even a genre. And I remember just having this conversation and Colette trying to convince me, like, let's start writing like a play. And I was like, what? Like, how are we, what does that even mean? And we started thinking about it, and then we connected back to these books we were familiar with, like these talking books that Paulo Freire had written, or bell hooks has this amazing, like, and really kind of accessible conversation with herself in this piece where she interviews herself between in Gloria Watkins and bell hooks, and sort of started to think about that. And I think in our first draft, we almost wrote it like a script, right? Like, we had Colette, colon, and then what you would say. And then we realized there's a lot of other stuff going on that we wanted to start capturing. Like, we had little kids, and like, how does that play into this? And I think in the end, we really wanted to be authentically true to, you know, I think recognizing that so much of writing happens after you've done the process of learning. And it situates people who are authors as some sort of brilliant people who actually don't engage in a learning process and don't struggle and don't have to make sense of it. And what I've found is that my learning happens through mistakes and struggle. It happens while I'm going to pick up my kids after school, and it happens in conversation with people like Colette, who push my thinking and challenge me. And so it's like, and then we write these pieces in academia and we put our name on it, and it's like misses the whole journey and all the hundreds of people that are behind you coming to some awareness of something, which are other people you're reading and other people you're talking with and your students in the classrooms. And so what we wanted to do was really, I think, capture that process and both celebrate the complexity and process of learning. And I think in the end, that's what autoethnography does, is it helps us enter into this reflexive space that is really important for doing work in the world.
Yeah, and I everything Eric said, 100%. And I would add to that that we were not interested in writing that sanitized version, right? Like, where whatever has happened, it's super cleaned up. All of the pain is taken out of it. All of the hardship is taken out of it. I don't think we teach like that. We had taught together when we were in grad school, and I don't think anybody on our teaching team taught like that or wanted to teach like that, because you're working with undergraduates who are sometimes really struggling, right? And they come in and they're like, oh, they can't share that or express that because they have to put on this front because it looks like everybody else around them at Berkeley is succeeding. So, you know, that making that vulnerability visible is a part of it, probably. I mean, I never taught TK-12 with Eric, but I can imagine that you taught that way. I know I taught that way teaching math. Like, you don't get it the first time, and it's not the point all the time to get the right answer. But like, how did we get it? Let's live there. So I don't think we were interested in a sanitized version of it. But also, I think academic writing also erases people who are deeply important to us, who not just accompany us on our journey, but like are in the journey, and they're in their own journeys, and their journeys cross over ours or parallel to ours. And I'm thinking of Carolyn Ellis's and her partner's piece on their abortion story. And it's like this, it's this academic piece that is so deeply personal and writing about something no one talks about, right? Like how the folks who are going through what they're going through, it's both deeply personal, but also it's a common narrative and story that needs to be honored and seen. And I think that parenting, while doing work that feels deeply meaningful, while having friendships and relationships with other people, while getting sick, while there's a snow day, you've got a kiddo, you know, who doesn't have to go to school, but your class is still going. And also wanting this strange thing called tenure, because you know it's going to create some security, you know, in your family's lives, but at the same time, you know, you don't really want to, you definitely don't want to get it in some way that doesn't feel good to you. Mm-hmm. So like even struggling with that, like what does it mean to be in academia? And, you know, I'm not a first generation college graduate or graduate level, but I am the first academic, and each, like every step was totally new, like totally, totally new. And even applying to undergrad, even though my parents had gone to college, like whole thing, totally new, all kinds of like, don't apply to financial aid, even though we need it, because then you don't get in, you know, like that meant like some really bad stuff happened down the line. And so there's something about the need to not sanitize, to be vulnerable, to make people in our lives who are really important to us visible, and to make that struggle and the questions that we have visible. And so in the writing, there were ways in which we had to manipulate the timeline in order to make it flow for the reader. But the conversations that we had, the questions that we had, the thing, like you know, the real tense disagreements that we had were, you know, awkward and also necessary to share, I think. And we had some really, and Eric mentioned a few, we had some really good, amazing, powerful role models, I think, who kind of laid a path for us to I don't know, welcome our vulnerability in this type of writing.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
And I think perhaps that's why it was so refreshing to read, because this vulnerability did come through, you know, this, the challenges in the process of academia, not just, you know, in the sort of process of sitting down to write and this task of writing, but also of being a whole human and having families and having a life and teaching and wanting to do the best for your students and engage in meaningful work. And I think this leads on then to my next question. I'd want to just take a step back then and wonder if you can explain this concept of an activist academic. How would you distinguish it, or would you distinguish it from a sort of regular academic?
I appreciate the question, and I think I might just push back just a teeny bit on that term regular academic. I think that you know, we talk about it in ways that make it seem neutral, but it's a very much a powered perception, right? Like a regular academic puts it as the norm. And I think it's the dominant version of an academic. It's the one that we don't question. We take as that's exactly what it should look like. And we, you know, we play around with it a little bit at the beginning of the book about like, who's the academic? It's this old kind of stodgy white dude who's in a dusty office with the jacket with the elbow patches and, you know, the has kids, but no one's ever seen them, probably has a partner, but only comes out, you know, for very particular events. And, you know, I think that that image is incredibly harmful, but also has some truth to it, right? It's an image because there is some truth to it because of who's had access and who has defined what an academic is, but more importantly, what an academic should look like, or who gets to be an academic, right? And so there's a very real way in which, just by virtue of being a full professor, I would argue that I would be an activist academic just by presence in the academy and shaking up what and who. But of course, there are ways in which I can certainly reinforce that older view, that dominant view. And so we wanted to go beyond kind of who an activist academic, but also what it is that they do. And so we do start, and you know, we've been talking about putting out another edition or an updated edition, because we do frame the work around teaching, research, and service. So what does activist teaching look like? What does activist research look like? What does activist service look like? And that framework in part comes from that dominant view, but it also comes from a framework that we were very much judged under as well. Mm-hmm. Right. So I get that. And I think that it was important, for example, when talking about what is activist research, it is redefining what impact means. It is not about your impact score. It is not about, you know, what, which journal you get into, how highly ranked that journal is, but it's really about, have you had an impact with others on the material realities that folks are facing, including yourself? What about scope, right? So we were trying to think about the work that we think academics are supposed to do as defined by a dominant version of an academic, and then think, well, but what does it mean to be an activist in those areas? Like, what does it mean to be an activist educator in the classroom, making space for? And I think this was particularly relevant during COVID. COVID is ongoing, of course, as well. And during the uprising of 2020, what does it mean to be an academic and recognize the hearts of your students in your classes, that, like, you know, that you honor everything that they're bringing and the ways in which they need to experience healing, as and you do as well, how that makes the classroom space something totally different than everybody sitting in rows. No one ever speaks except for the professor. This professor doesn't really know anyone's name, but is just kind of talking at them and doesn't really care what they learn so much as what they teach. And so we were kind of thinking within that about how much more, maybe that's another way of saying it, how much more an academic can be and do and partner with others to accomplish.
Yeah, and I appreciate all that you just said, Colette, but I would add that I think somehow the context has also shifted. Like, I think most people in academia believe that they're about social change and trying to make the world a better place. But I think the traditional notion was that you would write and present some new truths that would then change the way people operate in the world. And I think what we've seen, at least in the last couple decades, is that A, knowledge is deeply contested and truth is up for grabs, right? And so we can't just sit back and say, like, these are the truths I want to reveal to the world, and then the world will take them and run and make improvements, right? And so we started to think about, like, how do we enact justice, love in the world? And it's about the way we are making a difference in the lives of the people that we're touching, and not just the people who might read our work, which is typically in academia, other academics. And so we might be changing the thoughts of other academics, but how are we addressing the people who have the least, right? How are we addressing poor people who are completely marginalized from our society, the Black and brown children who are given the least advantages in our schools? And so what are we doing about that? And just like writing about that, it seems just too inadequate for me. It doesn't mean that my writing isn't a part of my activist work, but it's not alone. And similarly, my teaching isn't enough, right? And so how do I start to think about how do I really address those social realities and start to imagine different worlds? And so for me, it's moving beyond that traditional notion of academia that we only work in the world of ideas, and that even as I control my time, how am I engaging in research? And so we talked about both impact, as Colette mentioned, but we also, even though we didn't go deep into it, we recognized a lot of scholars who even think about the process, right? How are we humanizing our collaborations with our students, with people who were doing research in schools, outside of schools, and building the worlds we want to see in the spaces we occupy, right?
So then I want to ask you, sort of drilling down into that, how do we address these realities through being an activist academic? How can, you know, the work that we do in the academy sort of change the realities or have impact, and how can the scope be broadened sort of in the community?
I mean, for me, I start with where I'm at, right? So the communities that I'm working in, I worked in my kids' schools initially. I worked in the schools I worked with the young people who were involved in the different programs that I was offering, and tried to figure out what were the realities we wanted to tackle together, right? And so, you know, that's been a lot of my work, is sort of trying to build from where we are and listen to people and recognize that social justice starts with kind of how we see and interact with others around us. And what does it mean to be in right relationship with the people that we're working with? And then who are the communities that we're connected to, and how are we making those choices, right? And then how do we build that work out? And for me, it's been a lot about, you know, working with students at Clark who feel the most disconnected from Clark, and how do we create spaces for them that makes it more humanizing, while at the same time recognizing we need to imagine different worlds that aren't like most university systems, you know, recognizing that we have to humanize this while also recognizing that our whole education system is about sorting people and creating inequities. And like, as we are, you know, in higher ed, part of the high end of that hierarchy, how are we addressing other parts of it?
And so you also, oh, sorry, please go on, Colette.
No, go. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to ask you, because you also write about ways that theory as well can challenge the hegemony. Can you explain this as well? I guess it's perhaps a more traditional academic sort of question, but it was also really interesting to read about it.
I'm thinking about that, and I just want to add on to what you said earlier. So I'll, and I was thinking in my head, can I combine the two answers? I cannot. Just tease them out a little bit. Eric, I'm thinking back to Remy and Laura's work, anti-racist scholar activism. And we got a chance to present with them, I don't know how many years ago now, but they coined this phrase, reparative theft, that a part of being an activist academic, or they call it an anti-racist scholar activist, is figuring out how to use the ill-gotten gains of the university to redistribute it and give it back. And I think for me, at a Catholic institution that oftentimes doesn't see itself in the ways I see it and continues to perpetuate harm in the communities in which it's embedded and far beyond, a part of the way that I think we think of our work in when Eric and I, you know, applied for grants, or we're thinking about projects where we're partnering with folks in the community, we try and figure out how the money of the institution can go towards it in ways that community also has control over that money. It's not, as a researcher, I got this grant and I'm going to tell you exactly how I'm going to distribute it, and you get a little piece and you get a little piece and I keep a little piece for myself, but really trying to figure out what does, you know, reparative but reparative theft really look like. So I'll leave it at that I was thinking about that. But your other question about the importance and the role of theory in change, I think is also, I appreciate that question. I remember what theory did for me as a graduate student, mm-hmm. and also what I saw theory doing for the students who I got a chance to be in the classroom with when I was a graduate student instructor. And in particular, borrowing from the words of bell hooks, theory saves people's lives. It just really does, because the ways that you are thinking about yourself and your place in the world, and the ways that you make sense of what happens around you, is oftentimes through a deeply socialized lens, a lens that was socialized, in ways in which you were socialized to see the world in that way. And theory can shake that up and give you new explanatory ways of seeing things. And I'm thinking about Danny Solorzano, who talks about those lenses as a filter on a camera. And that filter on a camera, if I'm trying to take a picture of someone who's inside of a store and I focus my camera, I probably can't get a picture of them because of what I'm getting is a reflection of myself off of that glass. But when I use a particular filter, I can see through. And so he describes theory as that lens, that filter that allows you to see through. It gives you another way of seeing. And it's so critically important. I'm thinking about this project that we're working with a community organization with now to train Black adult community members, most of whom are over 50. And we start with theory before we get to methodology and research. And I remember a participant or student in the class saying, until I took this class, I thought racism, as a Black identified person in the U.S., I thought racism was over. But I knew things weren't right, and I thought it was me. And I think that's powerful. I'm not saying people can't or shouldn't take responsibility for the ways in which they're in the world. And there are also other necessary explanatory lenses that feel important, because it then creates a new theory of action. It then creates new ideas for how to engage in the world, right? And so I think theory has to be a necessary part. But I imagine, Eric, I know you have lots to add on that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. For me, you know, I was trying to make sense of a lot of pain when I went back to grad school, and even after when I became an academic, of what was happening with my students. And so making sense of our world is what theory is. It's making sense of what's happening around us. And I think we all do that. We all theorize, but we don't always do it systematically, right? And then we often will just internalize what I call kind of the myths that get constructed around us. And so theorizing to me is about thinking deeply about the dominant myths that surround us, right? So we talked at the beginning about like the myth of the academic, right? And in some ways, this book is trying to disrupt certain myths around that, right? Myths about these academics as heroes, but also myths about academics as not being a place of privilege, right? And so, you know, this struggle, and we try to challenge some of that myth-making that happens. And so to me, theory is about shifting what I call the dominant narratives that are operating all the time, and how do we reimagine or reconstruct narratives that would lead towards justice, towards healing. And for me, the whole process of like praxis work, right, which is about creating change in the world, has to involve theory. In fact, for me, there's like two steps on my cycle of inquiry. There's theorizing the problems that we're dealing with, and then theorizing change, right? And theorizing a theory of action. And how do we, and you know, people are doing stuff all the time, but we don't often learn from our mistakes and our successes unless we really theorize and try to make sense of it. And then that enables us to get better. And so for me, theory is, you know, what's that Maya Angelou quote of like, if you know better, you'll do better. And so theory is learning, right? Is knowing what's really going on. How do I make sense of social inequality, right? And the media and all these dominant narratives have all kinds of ways of making sense for us that if we don't deeply interrogate that, then we internalize these dominant narratives, which are patriarchal, white supremacist, capitalist. And so we have to imagine different realities. And that's what theory helps me to do, right? And it helps me to think, wow, this, if these things are socially constructed, how can I imagine a different world? And then for me, it's also like, it's like pushing myself. I remember I had this one student who was just like all about activism, didn't want to read the text, didn't want to read anything at one point. And I finally got her to read some piece by June Jordan. And she was like, oh my God, why didn't you make me read that earlier? And I was, and it like opened up all these ways of seeing. And I just was watching Dr. Crenshaw talk about intersectionality. And she just talked about like, we don't even see Black women being killed by police because we don't have a frame for that, right? Because the frames, so like these dominant narratives happen even in social justice spaces too. And so it's like, as soon as we create a frame to look at something, I think, which is the lens that Colette was getting at, suddenly things open up. We start to see things that we didn't before. And hopefully we make sense of the problems of the world, but theory also can help us make sense of the solutions, right? Ways we can approach it and learn and do things differently.
So then my next question is, and this sort of picks up on some of the earlier points that you raised in terms of thinking about, you know, when you said when you first started in academia, there was this tension between your activist work and also the demands of academic scholarship. So then how did you learn to combine these both in the course of your careers, and it comes through in the course of your book, in the pursuit of tenure? How do you juggle all of this?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it's other people keep pushing me to recognize that, like, I'll be honest, like this book, when we started it, I don't think we thought it was going to be something that would help us get tenure or anything like that, right? And I remember, you know, presenting at a conference, and John Saltmarsh was in the audience, and I was sharing these films that I had made with the youth. I was working in an after-school program, and we were doing critical media literacy, and the young people were then asking, like, how are people who look like me portrayed in the media or not portrayed, right? How are we invisible in different ways? and I was sharing one of the films, and John Saltmarsh asked me just point blank, he's like, do you have these films on your CV? And I was like, no, this is like my activist work in the community. And he's like, that knowledge, we need to reclaim what knowledge counts as valued knowledge. And part of the way we do that is, and so I was like, oh, okay. And so I changed my CV as a maybe a subversive act. I don't think when they reviewed my CV that they were out looking at my films. So then I had to go to the question when I send myself my stuff out for review, do I send a film that I was co-producer of, or do I send like an article, and even which articles, right? Do I send a autoethnographic reflexive piece, or do I send a more, you know? And so how are we even choosing how to represent ourselves in those traditional formats? And so for me, it's been this constant journey of trying to blend. I remember writing my statement for tenure and like telling stories in it. And one of my people reviewing it talked to me and says like, I like what you're doing here and everything, but like, you're not covering all the stuff you're supposed to be covering because you're giving too much time for these stories. And I'm like, and so I cut my story way down so I could add some other stuff. Some part of me regrets, like maybe I should have pushed harder. And, you know, it's not that big of a case, but I was, you know, playing with this idea of, you know, Edgewood Danticat talks about that while I write, it may not be life or death for me, but there are people in the world today who literally reading and writing are dangerous acts. And so what am I willing to risk in my own production of knowledge? And so that made me start to think differently about even the pieces I'm putting up for my case or for how we think about what counts as legitimate or valuable knowledge.
I love that. The idea of thinking about what I'm willing to risk in the production of knowledge, so important and so powerful. Now, one of the sort of themes that emerges in the book is your own positionality and the way this shapes your experiences of academia. And you do come from different backgrounds and are situated differently in the world. So can you tell me how, you know, your own positionality, and you've just mentioned frames of reference and different lenses and the way that social lenses sort of shape our experiences and understandings and our ability to solve social issues and social justice issues. So how does your own positionality shape your research, and how did it shape the process of writing this book?
Oh, another good question. And I, again, find myself still on the last question.
Sorry, please add to the last question as well.
It's so hard. Well, I do, in returning to the last question, I do think that there are ways in which other people, particularly those who had more institutional power, made our journey a little bit easier, perhaps to tell the story we wanted to tell, meaning do the writing we wanted to do and tell that story in the ways that we wanted to. And some of it was, you know, presenting some of this work at tiny conferences that, you know, people haven't heard of, and then having that one professor like Bill Ayers come in and just say, you know, I like what you got here. Or, you know, just one person to encourage it. Or I think we had a hard time finding a publisher who would take this book on. And John Saltmarsh was like, have you tried this place? Which turned out not to pan out, but then it like put us on a journey to meeting someone else. Like there were folks all along the way. But I also want to say that there were also folks who, I'm thinking about my very beloved dissertation chair advisor, who had a real vision for who I was going to be as an academic, which meant I was going to have to write in a very particular way. I was going to have to speak in class in a very particular way. And we just had breakfast, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. And the only reason we are friends to this day is because I wrote a scathing letter. I was like, you know, how dare you try and make me into someone else? And my paper is incredible the way it is. Like I had all kinds of attitude about it. It's the best paper in this class. I don't know who else's paper you're reading. And I didn't hear from him. I got whatever grade I got in the class. I think it was an A. And then the next time we saw, he didn't mention it at all. I was like, oh, well, this is kind of interesting. And then I went to go for my oral exam. And the person who was my chair was like, oh, you know, I don't think you're ready. I don't like the way you're answering these questions. And unbeknownst to me, behind the scenes, I didn't know at the time, but later he called and let me know. He went to bat. He was like, she has her own voice. And who are we to mold that in a particular way, right? Like, maybe we have something to learn. And he continued to go for bat. And even when I went on the market to try and figure out, like, what kind of job would be good for my family? What kind of job could I do that felt good for us in terms of what I wanted to do in the world, or what, you know, who knows what my daughter was going to want to do in the world? What was going to give us that? And every step of the way, he was like, okay, I think this is going to be good. If you go here, you can't go up from here. You can only go down. But if you go here, you can go up from here, right? Like, he had the inside, not just the social capital, but also the cultural capital for how you navigated that, which then allowed me some space. Now, I mention this because one of the people that both Eric and I love, David Stovall, gave this talk, I don't know, back in mid, I don't know, maybe 2010, that I was lucky enough to be at. And he was like, oh, you know, a lot of people ask, why do I come to a talk dressed like this? He had Timberlands on, he had a hoodie on and jeans. And he's like, I've made it. Now it's my job to make room for others to make it, to come as their authentic selves, to come not having to change their clothes to be considered an academic. And so, I see the efforts of my chair initially to be like, you know, in order to make it, you're going to have to be this way. And then he just kind of relaxed it and was like, you know what, you're going to be just fine. And I take that seriously in terms of now us being in the academy and making space for others to show up in the ways that they want to show up, so that their message doesn't get lost and how they want to share that message doesn't get lost. And they can then bring in the partnerships. Folks who are teachers can come back and be academics. Folks who are parenting can come back and be, anyone can be an academic, but we need to make space for them to be themselves and to do it the way that they want to do it. So I feel like we've been super lucky, and also we have this responsibility then. And I think about the doctoral students that I have who are doing this phenomenal work that I could never in a million years have thought of. And it's very much an expression of who they are, which then links to the other question that you're asking about our own positionalities and, you know, what we brought to the book. And I guess I would answer it a little bit differently in that we made space for each other to bring ourselves to this work. The book couldn't have been written if there was a conflict of belief in each other and a conflict of belief in the work that we were doing, right? We had lots of conflict. We're not shy about conflict. And, particularly about, like, I'm not even going to get into it, but there were things that, like, I was like, are you kidding me? Like, are you kidding me that you can't wrap your head around this and agree with me on this? And then there were things where he might say it a little bit more gently, a little differently, but it was conflict nevertheless. But what wasn't a conflict was seeing each other and how important family was to do our work with love, how to, you know, I never was under any impression that he was not a white man, white cis straight man. I don't think he was under any impression that I wasn't who I am. And we made a lot of room for each other, which I think is kind of this broader thing of making room for all identities to do the work that they want to do. And that if we make barriers, we make it hard for folks who come from, who are most oppressed by the systems that have been historically in place, and we are missing the most important stories. We're missing the most important lessons. We're missing the most important voices. And we couldn't do the work with each other by alienating each other. So the way we did our work with each other is very much along the lines of what believe about what we want to do in academia, making space for others.
And I guess I would say tied to that is, for me, love and a culture of love is a space where you have both accountability and forgiveness. And so, I mean, I can think of like many examples, but one I remember Colette had me come and speak at Vassar when she was there and had some intentionality about what she wanted me to say as a white man speaking to white people. And I came and spoke about something. I can't remember what it was. But afterwards, she was like, that's not what I wanted you to speak about. And I had a reason for you to be there. And I wanted you to bring your whiteness into the room in a different way. And so she checked me, right, and held me accountable. And I had to like hang my head and be like, apologize, but also forgave me and gave me space to think and grow. And I think that that's one of the things that I wrestle with a lot today, because I feel like, you know, I'm in a lot of spaces where it's a culture of forgiveness where we just let things slide and we don't call it out. And I'm in other spaces that are like cultures of accountability where people like performatively love calling people out, right? And I think a culture of love is a way where we embrace both and believe in the possibility and potential of each other, right? And so I am smarter, understanding, have thought about my work and my role in the world in so many deeper ways because of my longstanding relationship with Colette and the ways she's helped challenge me, push me, but also loved me to grow into my potential. And I've got a long way to go still. But
so then I just want to ask you, in challenging these traditional spaces in the academia and making space for activists, academics, do you have any key takeaways for listeners? It's quite a broad question.
Key takeaways. Do you have anything that comes to mind quick, Colette? I'll let you jump in.
You know, I'm always surprised. Well, I'm always surprised when someone said they've read the book. I'm always surprised when they said they've read it from cover to cover. and I'm always surprised when they say they enjoyed it. Like the number of times people have come up to me and said, oh, I can totally see you as the type of person who would be like way into lemon butt cakes. And, you know, okay, I don't really know what that means, but yeah, okay. I don't know. Which to me is like, they got the humor out of it. They got, you know, the very thing that Eric would tease me about all the time. Do you really need a second? And I'd be like, yeah, I do, because I still want it. Kind of a thing. They were like deeply engaged with us as people and as like friends. Like they felt like they were there. And I guess the takeaway and I'm thinking about both graduate students who are on this journey or early career scholars who are on this journey, is that they can too bring themselves into it, right? Like if you were that engaged, and I'm shocked that you were that engaged, what is the thing you really want to do? What is the work you really want to do that you feel like you can't do because there's no space for it here, or it's not welcome here? Or that you're doing, but you're doing it on the down low, right? Like you're not giving yourself credit for that in the ways that the academy gives credit to others. Like you are, the number of graduate students who are doing this really just amazing work with the different communities in which they're embedded, and they don't think to that it you know, counts, whatever counts means. I hate to use that word, but there I've used it. Trust in whatever that voice is. There is a way in which when we were writing this book, which started as just a series of writings and then articles and then became the book, that like something resonated, something felt honest about it. Something felt like, you know, it was like, yeah, okay, yeah. No one else might like this or get this or feel like it counts for anything, but it's deeply resonating with me. And it feels true. And it took a while to trust that voice. This feels true. And people who need to hear this are going to get it, right? And people who need to be supported in using the Academy's resources in other ways besides, you know, the stereotypical ways of using it, they'll get it, they'll hear it, and they'll need to hear it at the time that they need to hear it. And so I guess what I would love folks to take away, especially as early career scholars, is not necessarily what we were talking about in the book, but that we took a chance on how important we thought that message was for people to hear it in the ways that they heard it. And I want them to bet on themselves too.
Yeah. That's great. Sorry, Harry, keep going.
And just to quickly add on, I think the other thing is find a group of people who believe in you as well or have your back, because it emboldens you. And there's so many times when I felt like alone in what I was doing at Clark, but having Colette there. And then, you know, we talked in the last chapter about this camping trip, which is something we did annually with a group of folks that we had gone to grad school with and gotten to know. And it was just like, when you feel like you're completely out of your element, sometimes having that space where you can just recalibrate and be like, okay, I'm not insane. I what I'm doing matters, and this is meaningful. And I think having Colette's voice and some of my other friends' voices in my head emboldened me to actually be more audacious and more risk-taking in my institution. And what was interesting is the more audacious I became, the more I actually got more traction in the university, right? So some of the things that we're afraid to do are actually the very things that if we do might be disruptive, but also might wake, you know, get you the attention or create some of the changes you're trying to build in the institution. Not always. And I'm not saying I have won all my battles. Definitely not.
Yeah, those are really important messages. I want to go back and tell some of my students these. But yeah, so great. So thank you. Now, I've taken up a lot of your time today, but just before you go, one last question. What are you both working on now?
We're playing with the idea of a follow-up volume where we interview people who are we identify as doing this work and think about what they have to offer. I'm also working on another book with another colleague about how do we engage undergraduate students in activist research and what that looks like and how to do it and co-authoring with some of my students. And there's a few other projects, but I'll let you go, Colette.
Well, I'm looking forward to the whatever the second edition ends up looking like. I would love the opportunity to talk to folks who bring or define themselves as in a way that embraces the term activist, because I think we'll have a lot to learn from them. The project that I'm working on right now with a bunch of other folks is in the Bay Area using the Dream Keepers, and it's following the Dream Keepers initiative, training Black San Francisco adults to do research. And what I love about that project is that they are creating a methodology, which we've kind of temporarily called Black Community Activist Research, to do some collective organizing in their communities around issues that matter, and bringing kind of a research lens to it, an opportunity to create spaces for folks to testify about their experiences. And they attend as like these worthy witnesses, to use Maisha's term, to those experiences, and then to hold space for folks to think about, well, then what is it that they want to do? And so that's this opportunity to kind of exponentially multiply their experiences, folks who take in the class and then go out in the community and they're doing this work with others, and others are like, how did you learn to do this? And then they're teaching. And so for me, that's been a lovely joy. And so now a group of the students are writing a chapter about their experience in the first cohort of that. And then just more broadly thinking about how they might write it into a book, not because it only matters when it's in a book, but because when they did some, they presented a couple of times at some conferences, it was an opportunity for them to kind of sit back a little bit and think, well, what have I done? What have I done? And what does it mean? And then they're also engaging with people who are asking them really great questions and who are encouraging them in their work. And I think writing is not, as if I made this up, but writing is thinking, and it's an opportunity, and that reflection is so critically important for praxis. And so I'm excited to see where it goes. I don't know where it's going to go, but I'm really excited.
No, they all sound like great projects and actual proper academic activist projects. And hopefully we can have you back again when the books are published to chat about what comes out of those. So just to bring the interview to a close, I'm Jane Richards. I've been speaking with Professor Colette Camp and Professor Eric DeMolyneux. about their book, The Activist Academic, Engaged Scholarship for Resistance, Hope and Social Change. It was published by Myers Education Press in 2020. Colette and Eric, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having
so much. Yes, thanks.
It's been a pleasure.